From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 3,500 years ago in the Soconusco region of Mexico. An archaeological dig turned up the earliest evidence of human use of caffeine. A dig team found traces of chocolate, and why not? It's the home of some of the finest cacao in the world. That's the tree that grows the bean that gives us chocolate. According to legend, though, caffeine use might date back 5,000 years to ancient China. Emperor Shennong was boiling a pot of water to drink, they say, when some tea leaves blew into the pot. He drank the brew and displayed a healthy buzz. Tea culture was born, if you believe the story. Or maybe it was African goats, thousands of years ago, eating coffee beans and dancing a jittery jig, tipping off their owners about the jolt from caffeine. These stories are just the start of a fascinating new book about caffeine culture, appropriately named Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Murray Carpenter is a journalist who traveled around the world to track down caffeine and its roots, and he wanted to uncover some answers about why it's so difficult to know exactly how much caffeine we're really getting, and why it's not all that regulated in this country. Murray joins us for the hour. Murray, I'm coming off a morning tea for a sore throat, a latte as I finished reading your book. How about you?
I'm on my third cup of coffee of the day, and I'm feeling just about right right now.
You want to explain for our aficionados what kind of coffee you've had today so far?
Yeah, it's a medium roast Colombian coffee that I have a neighbor who roasts coffee right here in Waldo County, where I live on the coast of Maine. And so it's freshly roasted, freshly ground, drip filtered, pretty good stuff.
Very good. And later this hour, we're going to be joined here in studio. Murray's with us for the hour, and we've got some friends in studio as well who are going to be joining us. So I'll say a quick hello and welcome as they join us now from Joe Bean Coffee Roasters in Rochester. The owner of Joe Bean Coffee Roasters is Kathy Turiano. Kathy, nice to have you.
Hello.
Your coffee for the morning was what?
I had a natural Nicaraguan.
A natural Nicaraguan. Wade Reed is the director of coffee education for Joe Bean. Nice to see you, Wade. What did you have this morning?
This morning I had a shot of espresso and some of that natural Nicaraguan.
Very good. And Sarah Gilbert is a registered dietitian with UR Medicine. Sarah, you?
I had a medium roast at the hospital this morning.
And feeling good with it, huh?
Felt good, but I did have some dark chocolate, too.
Actually, Sarah walked in. The first thing she gave me was dark chocolate, though. Murray, I don't know if there are any nibs or just how much caffeine we get there, and we'll get there in a minute here. So you see that we're not here, by the way, Murray, to tell people to stop drinking coffee, right? Some of my listeners said this morning, is he going to tell us never to drink coffee again?
Boy, that's the comment I heard over and over again as I was researching the book. Just don't tell me I have to stop drinking.
Right.
And the answer is no. For most people, moderate caffeine consumption, moderate coffee consumption is perfectly fine. So if that's all you need to hear, you can sort of turn off the radio now and go back to your coffee.
But there's so much more to it. And I have to tell you, the book is beautifully done as a journalistic work, but it's not just a sort of a fact sheet. There's a lot of beautiful narrative nonfiction in this book. And I can't wait to ask you about some of your experiences and travels. I was a jealous journalist as I read it. But the target of the book's caffeine in all of its forms. For most Americans, that does mean coffee, a lot of us daily. But caffeine as a white powder had its earliest use not as a stimulant, but as an insecticide?
That seems to be its primary role. It's emerged independently in plants all over the world. And it's a very simple chemical compound. And it seems the primary function seems to be as an insecticide. But the interesting thing, as you mentioned in your introduction earlier, is that wherever it occurs in its natural form, people have quickly figured out that they can put it to use as a stimulant.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And too much of it can be deadly. I mean, most of us will never come in contact with enough to come anywhere near killing us. But you didn't have any trouble getting white powder caffeine. How much white powder caffeine, actual raw caffeine in a powder form, does it take to kill you?
Yeah, and this was something that surprised me. So it is in its essential form, the drug, the pure chemical compound caffeine is a bitter white powder, and you can order it online easily. I got a 100-gram bag for about $12, and it only takes 10 grams, which is about a heaping tablespoon, to kill you. Now, that's, it doesn't sound like a lot of powder, but that would be an awful lot of coffee.
Yeah, how many coffees would that, I mean, and again, we're going to talk about how difficult it is to measure caffeine in coffee, but what's a rough average of how many coffees that would take?
That would probably be 50 strong cups of coffee, 200 cups of tea, so you probably couldn't really do it.
Yeah. I also love the way how you describe how and why caffeine works for us. When we get drowsy, there's a neurotransmitter in our brain called adenosine that essentially signals to our body and our brain that we're tired. How does caffeine interact with our brain and adenosine?
Well, caffeine is able to look like adenosine to the neuroreceptors where adenosine should be parking. And it sort of parks in their spot and doesn't let adenosine get there to transmit the signal to the brain that we're tired. And so it blocks adenosine from delivering its signal. And when we're sort of optimally caffeinated, say in the morning when you've had your two cups of coffee, we're actually blocking probably 50% of the adenosine receptors in our brain. So it's a significant, it's a significant action in the brain right there.
And there are a lot of surprises in this book for me as a coffee lover, not the least of which is the fact that dark roast coffee generally has less caffeine than lighter roast. Why is that?
Yes, I'd love to hear from some of your coffee experts on this. It's because it's actually burned off in the roasting process. Now it's a tricky equation here, because bean for bean, dark roast coffee is going to have less caffeine, but the beans are also a little bit lighter because they're just, they have less moisture. But a dark roast bean versus a light roast bean, there is less caffeine in the dark roast coffee. It is a surprise.
Now, can I go off script a little and bring in Kathy and Wade here? And Wade, as the director of coffee education, bean for bean, there's a lot of different variables, but can you jump in on light versus dark roast and how we could understand in general caffeine there?
So my understanding, and this is based on research from coffeechemistry.com, anyone who wants to go look at it can find it, is that the boiling point of caffeine is actually so high, over 400, that very few roasters are actually getting up into those temperature ranges when they roast and actually boiling it off. So in theory, what he's saying could happen. Mm-hmm. Now, what I definitely wholeheartedly agree with is that there are other compounds in coffee that are burning off as you're getting up into those higher temperatures, or temperatures where caffeine doesn't burn off. So there's a higher concentration of caffeine in some of those lighter weight, darker roasted coffees. I think that is definitely true, but whether there's actually less is very disputable based on the boiling point of caffeine and how roasting is typically carried out.
Yeah, and there's so many variables. And Murray, in your book, you help us see just how variable it can be. You referred to some research Bruce Goldberger did, a forensic pathologist who studied coffee for its caffeine content. And the most stirring part of that research to me was the fact that he went to a Starbucks 6 days in a row and he made the exact same order at the same Starbucks, a 16-ounce cup of the breakfast blend. And then he analyzed it for caffeine content. What did he find?
Well, he found that the caffeine content varied so dramatically that one day, I believe it was as low as 260 milligrams, another day, 560 milligrams, which is really quite a whopping dose. And to put that into context, that would be 7 Red Bulls worth of caffeine in one cup of coffee.
In a 16-ounce cup of coffee. And how does that happen, Murray? Why?
Well, so there's a couple of different things that can go on here. One is obviously the brewing strength, so the ratio of beans to water. Now, in this case, he was likely controlling for much of that because Starbucks, I think, is pretty standardized about how much they're putting into their filter. The other thing is that caffeine is a natural product, and growing conditions, place to place, season to season, et cetera, can affect the caffeine levels in the coffee. So while that's a glaring example of how variable the caffeine concentration can be in coffee, it does tend to be variable, and there are a lot of factors that go into it. And it explains that sensation that so many of us have had, where one day you have one cup of coffee and you feel you're in sort of the perfect equipoise. Another day, the same cup won't even wake you up, and a third, the same cup makes you jittery.
Yeah, very interesting. We're talking to Murray Carpenter, the author of the new book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. We'd love to hear from you today, 263-WXXI, 263-9994, because we have a wonderful panel that can answer your coffee questions. We'd love to hear about your daily habits. And frankly, we're going to talk more about the word enough. It's such a weird sort of a variable here. But before we get into that, too, I do want to back up and say that Murray, our author, has said that we're living in a golden age of coffee. Why do you say that, Murray?
Well, and I think your panelists can address this. We over the last 20 years, the gourmet coffee, or the rise in specialty coffees, has made freshly roasted, freshly ground, well-prepared coffee available to so many of us, no matter where we live. I mean, at one time, these kinds of really excellent coffees that we now enjoy were limited to sort of pockets on the northeast and northwest coasts, or maybe around college towns. But it's really spread. And so now, it really is, I would say, we're in a golden age for coffee drinkers because of the widely accessible, delicious coffees that we have now.
You also write about the difference from country to country, town to town. And we know that. We know in the United States our coffee culture is different than it is in Italy and different than the tea culture would be in China, et cetera. But boy, did I love the way you described those experiences from country to country. And so you made me a little jealous about some of the things you had the chance to taste, because a lot of the time we're not going to have a chance to taste it if we don't go. Here's an example. Tell us about Pozole.
Yeah, Pozole. It's
Pozole. Okay.
Yeah, this is, and you mentioned in your intro that the earliest physical evidence for the human use of caffeine comes from the Soconusco region, which is the coastal plain on the Pacific coast, right near the border of Guatemala and Mexico, Chiapas, Mexico. And back 3,000 years ago, the pre-Mayan people were drinking a cold, frothy, cacao-rich drink, like a chocolate, a frothy chocolate drink. And you can still find vestiges of this on the landscape. In the town square of Tapachula, you can buy pozole, which is it's basically whole cacao beans ground up, kind of mashed up, and blended with corn. Sounds funny, but it's kind of like a whole food smoothie. Nowadays they use sugar, and historically they didn't. But it's really quite a delicious drink.
Yeah, you said it was rich and sort of velvety, and even though you describe it with the sort of the cacao and the corn, it's something altogether different than those individual elements, huh?
Yeah, quite different. Yeah, it really is delicious, and I don't know that it's going to ever spread, out of the area it's in, but it was a treat to taste that.
It should, Murray. I mean, my goodness, you can at least get a recipe and come home with it. But it's interesting to hear that you also had a chance to go to some places that were a little dangerous in South America, but you were able to find your way to some very interesting people who are at the top of the game in coffee growing. And I want to read a paragraph if we could, because I love the scene setting here. This is, you'd met Estuardo Falla. Is that his name?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, in the Antigua region of Guatemala.
Yeah, he writes, quote, I'd met Estuardo Falla, the fourth generation manager of Finca San Sebastian, at the conference in Guatemala City, and asked if I could come out to see the farm. I arrived ahead of schedule, and Falla, a quietly friendly young man in a peach-colored polo shirt and faded jeans, asked if I wanted to join his other guests, coffee growers and salesmen from Guatemala, Panama, and Colombia, for lunch. We ate in a one-story building with a kitchen behind a wall on one end and a bar two steps up on the other end. Both of the long sides had large windows opening onto neat grassy fields in the foreground, rows of coffee trees in the middle distance, and the volcanoes rising beyond. With cowhide rugs, rustic leather chairs, tile floors, exposed beams, and a single orchid on the long wooden dining table, it was the picture of understated elegance and could have been the setting for a Colombian telenovela or a Ralph Lauren ad. I imagine the coffee tastes so much better when you're sitting there, and that's part of what you write. But at the same time, how special is it to you to have a chance to taste the coffee right where it is grown?
Well, very special, yeah. And I think those of us... And it's not just coffee. Of course, the local foods movement is now much about this. But coffee is, as one of my sources described it, an experiential beverage. And so it's not just the flavor of coffee, which is, of course, very important, but where you're drinking it, and often who you're drinking it with, because it, you know, the social aspects of coffee drinking are a really big part of it. So all of these sort of factor in to give you your experience of coffee drinking. And yes, that was a really surprising and one of those unexpected lunches that I had along the way that at that nice coffee farm in Guatemala.
And yet, when you were in Colombia, you also had a similar experience, maybe a little bit more rustic, and a chance to drink a cup of coffee made locally. And yet, The coffee there wasn't that good. And why was that?
Yeah, and it would be coffee that to the American palate wouldn't taste so good. So it was the leftover beans that the farmer. This was a small farmer, not a big plantation like the one in Guatemala, but a small farmer who owns his own land and grows coffee as part of a small diverse farm, and he holds back some of his less than market quality beans for his own use, and then roasts them on the wood stove and tends to roast them quite dark, and then grind it very fine and boil it for, you know, without unfiltered. So it's the kind of coffee that most of us wouldn't set out to prepare. But again, the sitting there on his farm drinking his coffee that was grown, you know, 100 yards away was really quite a special experience.
And yet I was a little depressed to hear that he was also sending most of the good stuff away. You'd want the locals there to have a chance to taste the best stuff, but a lot of the good stuff goes elsewhere.
It does, and you know, something has changed in Colombia a lot. I mean, the first time I visited Colombia was, I think, 1982, and then it really was hard to get a terrific cup of coffee in Colombia. Now they have really a burgeoning coffee culture, and Juan Valdez, which everybody knows the name Juan Valdez, who was the spokesperson for the Colombian Coffee Federation. There's a chain of cafes now, Juan Valdez cafes, which are sort of like what we would recognize as a Starbucks or a gourmet cafe chain that has terrific coffees, and they're throughout Colombia now.
We're talking to Murray Carpenter, the author of the new book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Not just about coffee, but, you know, it's easy for me to fixate on coffee, especially because I work in an office now that has a Keurig machine here, the single cups. And Murray writes in the book about how so much changed in American coffee culture. We got away from the cold coffee pots that were just sitting around the office that were, frankly, pretty nasty. And it was a gentleman who founded Green Mountain Coffee who saw an opening here. And Murray, what I was surprised to learn was he had experience in the notion of delivering a drug experience, which, you know, caffeine in small levels is fair to call it that. But this gentleman who founded Green Mountain Coffee in the 1980s, created quite a drug experience when he created better rolling papers for marijuana, didn't he?
Yeah, and that really surprised me. So yeah, this is Bob Stiller who founded Green Mountain Coffee Roasters and grew it to be, you know, the big profitable company it is today. And he in the 70s and early 80s that was, like so many people way back in those days, a lot of people were smoking marijuana, and they found that cigarette papers were too narrow to roll a joint. So he and a friend founded a company called Easy Wider, which the rolling paper company is still around, which its innovation was to have a wider rolling paper. And when he sold that company, that was the money that he used to stake him to buy a local coffee roaster that he eventually grew into Green Mountain Coffee Roasters.
And here's the part of the book that I should have known, but I haven't thought about, and that is this. If we go to Joe Bean Coffee Roasters and you drink the coffee that they're roasting and preparing and grinding there, oh my gosh, it is so good. And I get bags of stuff from Joe Bean Roasters and we have it at home. It's part of the Good Food Collective. We get it. But Murray, once in a while at home, my wife and I will grind the beans, we'll use what we need, and then we'll put the rest of the grounds in a jar for a few days. And then a couple days later, it starts to taste... Wade just winced. I think I actually physically injured our coffee educator in here. Because a few days later, it tastes like hot water. And as you write, oxygen, and I should know this as a wine writer, I know the effect of oxygen on wine. Oxygen impacts coffee grounds. And what Green Mountain did was they took out the oxygen and they added what to the equation?
Nitrogen. They displaced it with nitrogen. And I also toured a coffee roaster, community coffee. This isn't in the book, but it's part of the research I did in Louisiana. And they flush some of their coffee as well with nitrogen. And essentially what it does is displace the oxygen to prevent that exact problem you're talking about, where the instant that you grind your coffee, and again, your experts could talk about this better than I, from that point on, it starts to lose its flavor, and it's oxygen that tends to do it.
Yeah, and the good news is in 5 or 10 minutes or an hour or two, you don't lose everything. But boy, I'll ask you, Wade, let me ask you. First of all, I apologize for sharing that story, but understand, I have a 2-year-old. My 2-year-old loves to help grind the coffee, but he sometimes overdoes it. So you would probably advise me not to just jar up the grounds there for a few days?
Coming from also having a 2-year-old, totally understandable.
Okay. Okay.
But I will say that there's a whole class of aromatic compounds called surface aromatics. It's the stuff that's closest to the actual origin. It's stuff that's the result of the growing process. Sits right there on the surface of the bean. The second you grind that bean, that starts to fly off. That starts to take off, and after 5 minutes, you've lost 50%. So,
wow.
Yeah, the rapid it's some really astonishing math, the rapid off-gassing and the loss of aromatic compounds. So, you know, I know the trials of having a 2-year-old and trying to make coffee, and, you know, I do it the way we do it at
Joby. And they want to participate. They have fun with it, yes.
Exactly, exactly.
I guess the key is if he over grinds it, just drink more or just suck it up and grind it fresh the next time. But Murray, you know, interestingly enough, in the book, as you write, when Green Mountain sort of unlocked this formula and they used nitrogen, I mean, I'm not saying Green Mountain coffee is as good as you'll get in a Joe Bean Roasters or Fina's next door to us or somebody else, but did coffee sales and consumption rise with this K-cup industry?
Well, the K-cup certainly rose. And, you know, the K-cups have certainly tracked with a couple of trends in coffee in the U.S. The one that I mentioned earlier is that the specialty coffee boom that has really helped to boost coffee sales nationwide over the past 10 to 15 years. And the other trend that Green Mountain's a part of is this trend towards single-serving coffee, it's not just K-cups, but also Nespresso capsules, for example, by Nestle. So, yeah, there are two things going on, and both seem to be quite popular.
We're talking to Murray Carpenter, the author of the book Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. And also in studio, Kathy Turiano is the owner of Joe Bean Coffee Roasters. Wade Reed is the director of coffee education. Sarah Gilbert is also here. She's a registered dietitian with UR Medicine. We're going to take the shortest break in radio and come right back. And we're going to talk about, we're going to sort of broaden the discussion now that we gleaned from this wonderful new book from Murray Carpenter and get some of your comments and questions. We already have a lot coming in from social media online as well. And you can call the program 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We want to know what your daily coffee or chocolate or tea habit is, and we'll help filter that out of our discussion today. You're listening to Connections with Evan Dawson on member-supported public radio. All right, welcome back here, and we're talking caffeine, caffeinated, and Murray Carpenter is the journalist who put this book together, and I want to kick the conversation over to our registered dietitian with UR Medicine, that's Sarah Gilbert, because as Murray writes in his book, Sarah, we're talking coffee, but we're also talking a whole wave of other products out there. You work with athletes, and athletes will now come to you and say, caffeine, yes or no, will that help me? In general, and I know it's sort of a broad question, but how do you start the conversation with athletes who are wondering if caffeine will help them?
That's a really good question, and there is a lot of research, especially with cycling, about caffeine improving endurance performance. That being said, the NCAA considers caffeine regulated, and they do test for it on the drug tests. So if I'm working with my NCAA athletes, you know, it's something to be mindful of, because if you have a couple cups of really strong coffee and then get drug tested, you might be in trouble. For the general recreational athlete, as long as they know how much they're getting in, I usually just make sure that they have a good refueling plan along the way.
And you mentioned coffee, but what are some of the other products that you see now in the athletic circle, Sarah?
There's a lot of energy gels, like goo products. Mm-hmm. There's shot blocks from Cliff. There's also a new drink tablet that used to just provide electrolytes, but they just added caffeine into it. And that's kind of where it gets kind of dangerous, because if you're not sure how many tablets you're putting in and how much caffeine that might give, you could run into problems.
And how much of those products do come with proper labeling to let you know exactly how much caffeine you're getting?
Usually the sports nutrition ones will label the caffeine because they want to give their athletes an idea of just how much their product is providing. The things that don't label them are more the protein powders that you might find that have proprietary blends of creatine and bitter orange and caffeine, which in combination can be even fatal sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Murray, part of your research revealed that on the regulation scale, caffeine's sort of gotten away clean for a while. Give me a sense for how well regulated you think caffeine is and what you've observed the FDA doing in recent years.
Well, something that Sarah just mentioned is one of the big problems with energy drinks as well. Is some will just say, and instead of listing, you know, clearly the caffeine quantity on the label, they'll say proprietary blend includes X, Y, and Z, but has no quantity. And I think the basic information any consumer needs if they're consuming an energy drink or any other product with a specific amount of caffeine in it, that, you know, as opposed to coffee and tea, which can vary widely, we need to know how much caffeine is in it. And FDA is now looking at energy drinks and other products with added caffeine, trying to figure out how best to regulate these products. And I suspect that what we'll see come out of this is, at a minimum, some requirements for better labeling.
Murray, about 100 years ago, caffeine was, tell me about the Coke connection and why caffeine regulation went the way it did, even 100 years ago.
Yeah, and this was one of the things that really surprised me in researching the book, is that 100 years ago, in 1909, there was a very hard-charging commissioner of the agency that would become the Food and Drug Administration. His name was Harvey Wiley, and he thought that the caffeine added to Coca-Cola was an addictive drug, that the Coca-Cola was being marketed to children, and that the federal government should regulate it. And it's worth noting that in those days, the caffeine concentration in Coca-Cola was much higher than it is today. An 8-ounce serving had 80 milligrams, so exactly the size and caffeine concentration of a modern Red Bull. And this wound up being a court case pitting the federal government against Coca-Cola over the addition of caffeine to its products. And the funny thing about this is, even 100 years ago, the questions they were asking were the same we're asking today about energy drinks. I think we're still having a hard time sort of wrestling with this issue. You know, should they be marketed to children? Is caffeine different when it's a naturally occurring product of coffee or tea, or when you're adding the powdered form to a beverage? And specifically, the last question is, really, what role should the federal government play in regulating caffeine?
A fair question that comes up often in your book, Caffeinated, and as much as you did have access to so many different people around the world, growers and baristas and tea shops and seeing the different culture in Europe and China and so many others, there were a few places that you could not get into. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the big frustration for me was not being able to visit one of these synthetic caffeine plants. Now, there's essentially two ways to get the caffeine powder that's blended into colas and energy drinks. One is to refine it from coffee beans or tea leaves, et cetera. And I did visit a coffee decaffeination facility in Texas, where they produce more than 1 million pounds of caffeine every year by extracting it from coffee beans. But most of the caffeine that we use in this country now is synthesized, so cobbled together from chemical precursors in overseas pharmaceutical plants. And I found out it's quite an opaque industry, and I approached pharmaceutical plants in Germany, India, and China. None would let me visit, but I did get at least to see the outside of the world's largest caffeine plant in China. And so that's as close as I got.
You chatted very briefly with some workers as well, but it had the shroud of secrecy. What did you learn just being there, even if you couldn't get in?
Well, just being there, I guess it was not at all what I expected. I don't think you'll see this this neighborhood and this facility being, you know, plastered on any corporate reports anywhere. It was sort of a dingy, rundown industrial park outside of a town of 10 million, a cluster of pharmaceutical plants. And, you know, it's in this sense, caffeine sort of parallels much of what's gone on in our pharmaceutical industry. The industry's been offshored, and the Food and Drug Administration is trying to play catch-up with inspecting these overseas plants.
On our Facebook and Twitter pages, we're getting a lot of comments here, some of them making me laugh, because I said that our first hour today is all about caffeine. Joan writes, my first hour today was all about caffeine, too. And Holly wants to write in and talk about phasing out caffeine. Holly writes to us, I've tried to phase out coffee consumption. Usually now just have it on the weekends for the experience. I do wheatgrass shots during the week instead. Let me ask our registered dietitian, Sarah Gilbert from UR Medicine. Wheatgrass shots instead of caffeine? What do you think?
I mean, that's not something I've heard of practicing, but I think that different things work for different people, mm-hmm. and that if it's helping her to feel better, then it's not something I would discourage.
Yeah, there's Sarah, there are a lot of questions or comments about how to reduce the intake. And before we get to withdrawal and addiction, and we are going to get back to, as a coffee lover, I'm going to steer us back to the great parts about the ritual of coffee. And we're going to talk to Joe Bean, the folks from Joe Bean and Murray as well, about what does make coffee such a nice companion. But I'd love to hear from listeners. Twitter, Facebook, online, and 263-WXXI, 263-9994, about whether you do think in any way that you're addicted to coffee and whether you've tried to limit your consumption. Murray, you had to answer a question in your book, whether you wanted to use the word addiction. And as you write, some people find that offensive or a loaded term. Why did you decide to use the term?
I think because for the layperson, this is how we understand it. I mean, yes, clearly addiction's a loaded term. I don't mean to suggest it's anything like an opiate addiction or even, you know, an alcohol addiction. But caffeine at a much lower level has all the hallmarks of an addictive drug, which is to say, once we're habitual users, we crave it, we use it every day, we develop a partial tolerance to it. And we will experience most of us will experience some withdrawal symptoms if we cease using it abruptly. So probably best to characterize it as a mild addiction and one that's likely not harmful for nearly any of us. But regardless, it does have the characteristics of a drug of addiction.
And Murray, what is the average American's daily intake of caffeine and how much does it break down with coffee?
Probably about 240 milligrams, and about two-thirds of that in the American diet is coffee. Interestingly, coffee, those of us who drink coffee daily drink more, so we skew the averages a little higher. We're probably close to 300 to 400 milligrams, and the people, and there are many who just get their caffeine from soft drinks, they're tending to have less caffeine in their diet, even if they're taking it daily, because the concentrations are so much lower in soft drinks.
We've been using the term for decades in this country, having a cup of coffee, but sort of the supersizing of the industry has made a cup of coffee pretty large these days. What do you consider a cup, Murray?
Yeah, that's hard, and I did try to define this in the book, and it's an easy term to talk in terms of a cup of coffee, but for me, so I tend to have 3 to 4 6-ounce cups of coffee. But again, if you talk to someone, one person's cup of coffee may be 16 ounces, one person's cup of coffee may be 5. So it's really a problematic term to measure caffeine just by cups of coffee.
And when it comes to withdrawal symptoms, we have a lot of questions about this from people who have said, for example, Benjamin online writes in about, for years, 8 cups of caffeinated coffee in the morning, 4 to 6 cups in the afternoon. Now I try 4 to 6 cups of decaf in the morning, once a month, 1 cup of caffeinated. He says, I took it slow, half calf for months, then third calf, then quarter, then eighth calf, but still had a week of headaches. even when I went away from caffeine entirely. We're all different, Murray, but what did you find when it comes to the question of withdrawal?
Yeah, I mean, that was a real surprise for me, is that most of us will experience some withdrawal even on a low level of caffeine consumption, so 100 milligrams, which may be six or 8 ounces of coffee daily, or 3 cans of Coke, or 2 bags of black tea. If you're on that level daily, you'll probably experience some withdrawal symptoms. But your listener did it the exact right way. I mean, the best way to minimize the withdrawal symptoms is to taper back. But as he said, even tapering back, if you have a high level of caffeine consumption, it can be unpleasant to kick the habit.
Let's ask Sarah from UR Medicine, a registered dietitian, if withdrawal has ever come up for you. You're a coffee drinker. Have you had to cut back at any point?
I did have to cut back at one point. I was going through officer candidate school with the Marine Corps, and they don't let you have caffeine there, even though I know in your book, Murray, you talk about SEALs in training using it during their hell week. But we had to go cold turkey, so I went the longest period since I was a teenager. I had to go 4 weeks without coffee, and it was pretty painful.
So you got the nutritional experience firsthand, not hearing it from other people.
That is correct.
Withdrawal is real. To Murray's point, we could go through withdrawal even if we don't fully eliminate caffeine. But you're not telling people eliminate caffeine entirely, are you, Sarah?
No, I'm not. And I think it's really important to know that caffeine, like most issues within nutrition, you know, they vary by person. Mm-hmm. And there's no right amount for one person versus the other.
Let's steer it back, if we could, to what I love about coffee, which is the ritual and the routine of it. I read a book called The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg, a New York Times writer, and he wrote about the fact that every day in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he liked to go get a cookie with a coworker. And he realized that what he really wanted was just to get away from his desk and have a little interaction with somebody. He didn't need the cookie. But I'm telling you, I like to go to Joe Bean Coffee. I like to go to Fina's next door. And I do need the coffee. Let me ask Kathy Turiano, the owner of Joe Bean Coffee. It is about great coffee, but it's about the experience too, isn't it?
Absolutely. I actually think that our whole thing is about experience. Mm-hmm. We do use coffee for that, but It really is about that comfort, about community, about coming together and connecting over something. And, you know, in our case, it happens to be coffee. And we do promote quality coffee and that interaction even with the barista.
Before, let's hold that thought there because I want to weigh in on a couple points there. But we've got Bob from Honeyway Falls on the line. Go ahead, Bob.
Oh, yes. Excuse me. I found out I reduced my caffeine consumption by simply going to a desktop coffee warmer, in that I found I hated drinking coffee when it was cold, so I was always refilling the coffee cup. Probably cut my daily work time coffee consumption in half.
So, Bob, you're saying you'd get a cup of coffee, and if you didn't finish it, you'd go get a whole other fresh cup of coffee to be hot. And now you pour a cup of coffee, and you can keep it warm and stick to one cup?
Yeah, a little $10 desktop coffee warmer. It doesn't overheat it like a coffee pot will, but just keeps it just warm enough, and I found out I was drinking a lot less coffee.
But you're still drinking coffee and enjoying it in the afternoon, huh?
In the morning, yeah.
Thank you for the call, Bob. I appreciate that. We'd love to hear some more stories from our listeners, if we could, about this issue. And for me, I'm somebody who has suffered migraines for a good amount of years. And one of the suggestions from my neurologist was during a migraine, caffeine helps, but regular caffeine, if you consume it at high levels, could be a trigger. We don't know. I think there's still a lot of research about that. But I've tried to drink more sort of half-caf, half-decaf, but I still want the experience. And, you know, Kathy, I wonder, Kathy, if you've heard from customers similarly that they still want the experience, even if they're drinking decaf. And there's nothing wrong, I've learned in the last year when I switched to more decaf. There's nothing wrong with decaf, is there?
No, absolutely not. There's nothing wrong with decaf. And again, I do think it is about connecting over a beverage and really having that experience and enjoying it. I mean, Do you enjoy it?
I do. I need it at 6 a.m. before my son gets up on the weekend, just to have with a book in my hand for that feeling. I love the ritual of meeting a friend and sitting down with a warm beverage. And so, you know, the one objection I have, Murray, is that in the book you say it's definitely a caffeine delivery mechanism. Is that the CDM? Is that the
exactly.
It's
yeah.
definitely a CDM for sure.
Yeah,
but I don't necessarily have to have the caffeine. I want that ritual. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, right. And other people have suggested this to me. I think I would believe that the ritual was the primary thing behind coffee if most people who enjoyed the ritual hadn't come into it through the caffeine in the first place. You know, it tends to be the caffeine that draws us back. But, yeah, some people do shift to decaf. And it's worth noting about decaf. And the other thing about the golden age of coffee that I didn't mention is, you know, part of the reason decaf got a bad reputation years ago for not tasting good is because it was often made with sort of substandard leftover beans. And now we can get, you know, quite a few really delicious decaffeinated coffees that are, you know, made with and roasted with care. So I think it is, for a lot of people, it's a great alternative.
Yeah, Wade, you want to jump in on that point about decaf coffee? I admit that I didn't want to go to – I still drink a lot of caffeinated coffee, but I drink more decaf than I ever did. And I didn't want to because in my head, the notion of decaf was bad coffee.
Yeah, I think that's a very common notion. I think at Joe Bean, we're only bringing in what's called mountain water processed decafs. And so this is all clear glacier water. It's coming, you know, straight off the mountain. No chemicals added. It's different from the Swiss water process, which is still involving some levels of formaldehyde, according to some research. So I think Jill Bean and a lot of other specialty roasters are making the effort to bring in beautiful decafs. And like I said, I have a 2-year-old son. When my wife was pregnant, I was drinking a lot of decaf, and I was very happy with it flavor-wise. And I think, you know, what Murray refers to as the golden age, I would call the third wave. Third wave has really emphasized making better decaf, making better decaf mm-hmm. espresso, making better decaf cups, really to everyone's benefit. I can honestly say that I thoroughly enjoy beautiful decafs from a few different roasters.
Murray, a question from Kelly on Twitter wants to know, what's the deal with caffeine in chocolate? And you covered this pretty extensively in your book. How do you want to tackle that one?
Yeah, well, the chocolate's an interesting case, and because originally I'm sure that a lot of the appeal in Mesoamerica and later in Europe was that strong chocolate does have significant amounts of caffeine. But because we take it now mostly in milk chocolate, which has a very low concentration of cocoa or, you know, the actual cacao bean, it tends to also have a very low concentration of caffeine. But if you the new much more the chocolate bars are much more available now than they were, say, 15 years ago, that have 60% or 70% cocoa solids will have a significant amount of caffeine. So that, say, a Hershey's sized chocolate bar with a lot of with 70% cacao will have probably as much caffeine as a cup of tea.
I have a note from Jeremy who wants to know, is coffee really like wine? I've enjoyed very good coffee at places like Joe Bean, but can you really pick up all of those aromas that are listed on the bag? Wade, I'll start with you.
Absolutely. If we put it on the bag, it's because it was an experience we had when we were doing our different yep. quality control tastings. Now, that said, everyone's palate is different. Mm-hmm. Taste and smell are the two senses most closely tied to memory. And so your memory actually tells you what you're tasting and smelling. And so it might be something where we've said it tastes like this because we were locked into, you mm-hmm. know, this is in our palate. Your palate might perceive it totally differently. It might be super pleasant to you still, but it might not at all taste like what's on the bag to you. So I think you can, but what people need to do is slow down, sip your coffee, and actually think about it. Slow down, eat your food, and actually think about it. You know, tasting is not the same as consuming to me.
Yeah, we're in a culture where we eat and taste and we do things very, very quickly.
On the go. Yep.
And in Murray Carpenter, we're talking to Murray Carpenter this hour, the author of the new book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. And for Jeremy's question, Murray, you bring that up in your book, and you do point out that for a lot of people, yeah, you want coffee to be acceptable. If it's great, it's a bonus. Most people aren't thinking about it the way Wade says. But at the same time, you write about different cultures. You write about the fact that in Italy, there's a charge to sit down in a cafe. So a lot of people stand up and take their espresso on the go. Whereas in China, for the people who love tea, there are some who get kind of lower quality tea, but others will sit with it for a while, the same way I or Wade or Kathy might sit with coffee for a while. So I guess everybody has a different goal for the outcome of the products we're consuming.
Yeah, that was one of the fascinating things, was to see how different cultures consume their caffeine differently, and to see how these things are all changing so quickly. And for example, in China, where I went through these fairly elaborate tea tasting rituals with tea sellers, just around the corner, there was a shop selling Red Bull and bottled teas. So even now, these habits are changing place to place.
You write in the book, Scandinavians like their coffee strong and abundant. And this, I thought this was sort of funny. Residents of Sweden, Norway, Switzerland, and Finland all drink twice as much coffee as Americans. The average Swede drinks 1,460 cups of coffee annually. This helps to explain the 100 references to coffee in Stieg Larsson's bestseller, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I didn't pick up on it, but apparently you counted the references, Murray.
Yeah, well, it seemed like every time you turned around in that book, they were going for a coffee. But, you know, it's worth noting here, and your coffee experts can certainly know this, but most Americans don't seem to know this, that we Americans used to drink far more coffee, too, than we do today. And coffee consumption peaked here around 1950, and it seems to be the competition from soft drinks that have really that drove coffee consumption down. And as I mentioned earlier, we've recovered some of that over the last 10 to 15 years, but we're still far below the per capita consumption that we had around 1950.
Yeah, last question, and we're running out of time. Last question for Sarah Gilbert, registered dietitian from UR Medicine. Can we all agree that soft drinks are something that if we surgically remove soft drinks from the American diet, we'd be generally better off?
Oh, absolutely. There's so many different components of soft drinks that can affect your body negatively. Now looking at caramel coloring in recent studies versus, just the plain amount of sugar that are in them.
Boy, oh boy. So it's too bad to see that coffee consumption is at a lower point than it was in 1950 when, as Murray writes in the book, our grandparents were drinking stuff that we would think is plonk today, weren't they, Murray?
Yeah, it was not the wonderful coffee we're drinking today.
Final words from our friends at Joe Bean Coffee Roasters, and we appreciate you coming in, Kathy and Wade, here. What's your takeaway here as we look at not only caffeine but American coffee culture? Kathy?
I actually do agree with Murray that we are coming into the golden age of coffee. I do think that we were not drinking as much coffee as we were, only because there were so many coffee places to connect over and with, and those are what's coming back. Those places are coming back, and therefore we're coming back into connecting over coffee as a society and as a culture.
Wade?
Just anecdotally, my wife is from a farm in central Iowa, and she's from a family of nine, and it's always one kid's duty to keep the coffee pot full. So I kind of have had a taste of that coffee all day, and it's definitely not as interesting to me as sitting down having my one or two cups in a day that I'm actually really focusing on, zeroing in on, thinking about, and processing as I drink.
And Murray, I've got 30 seconds. Our listener Leo wants to know, you didn't ask Murray how much he's drinking on a daily basis and if he cut down on caffeine after writing the book.
Okay, I did cut down slightly. I probably cut down about 25%, yeah. But I'm still drinking 3 to 4 small cups daily and very much enjoying it.
Well, I really enjoyed the book. Beautifully done, and certainly applies to so many of us. It's no wonder that the book seems to be everywhere. It's called Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. And I'm happy to know after reading it that I feel smarter, but I don't feel compelled to give it up entirely, Murray. Thank you for helping me understand our world a little bit better.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on.
Murray Carpenter, that's the book, easy to find online. We'll link to it on our Twitter account. Thanks to Kathy and Wade from Joe Bean Coffee Roasters. We appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
And Sarah Gilbert, our registered dietitian from UR Medicine. Thank you, Sarah.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, quick break. If you are a Time Warner Cable customer, you can watch us on City 12 for the next hour. Connections continues on a Wednesday afternoon.